I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Patrick, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. You know, you and I met through our mutual friend, Mike Del Ponte, who has referred a number of really interesting people to me when I had asked him for people that, you know, I may not have heard of or haven't appeared on 1,000 other podcasts. And, you know, when I looked at your story and your background, I was immediately intrigued. So rather than give it away for our listeners, can you tell us a bit about yourself, your background, your journey, and how that has led you to everything that you're up to now?
Yeah, definitely. So I grew up in Fort Collins, Colorado. I think that I kind of have that grounds me in sort of a Midwestern/Western upbringing. I went to school at a very conservative Baptist college, but I think I always had my sights set on living in New York City. However, I didn't actually end up here in New York City until I was 30, because in between the time that I was in school down in Florida and had moved back to Colorado for a couple of years and was a ski bum in Aspen, I had moved out to Los Angeles for a couple of years to pursue acting for a little while. And at a certain point, I moved to Frankfurt, Germany, where I was pursuing graphic design, which is what I studied in college for 3 years before I actually made my way to New York City. So I kind of had a combination of travel, cultural education, jobs within hospitality and restaurants and hotels, and the kind of like art and design background to my career, as well as performance as well. And I sort of grew up in theater in addition to having kind of pursued a career somewhat in Los Angeles as well. So I think that kind of my pursuits as I was growing up from kind of laid the groundwork for all of the things that I'm doing currently.
Hmm. So just to give people some context, what is the work that you're currently doing?
Well, there's a lot, actually, and I'm very fortunate to be in a place that I'm kind of pursuing all of the various endeavors that I've kind of always dreamed of. To sum it up, my kind of main platform is Instagram. A lot of people know me as at a guy named Patrick on Instagram, where I showcase photos of my life in and around New York City and in travels abroad and around the country. And a lot of the focus of the images that I showcase have to do with various lifestyle pursuits, food, travel, fashion, culture. And so I've developed an audience of over 400,000 followers on Instagram. And in addition to that, I co-founded with my friend Amy Buchanan a group here in New York called Spring Street Social Society, in which we curate and host a series of sort of one-night-only events that combine cocktails, dinner, performance in various combinations. And we also have a series of about 200 members who are dues paying members who are the guests who attend most of the events, in addition to a number of tickets set aside for kind of the general public, people that have found out about us. And one of the tenets that makes Spring Street Social Society so exciting, other than just being an opportunity for us to sort of play creatively with food, drink, performance, it really brings people together in New York City in a way that I think a lot of people are looking for community, and we hopefully provide that for a lot of people. But what's really fun and exciting for us is that we have this sort of secretive aspect to what we do, and that people don't really know until a couple of weeks before the event that it's happening. And once they've purchased tickets, they don't know until the day of the event where it's actually being held. Although we're pretty adamant that we like to stay in Manhattan, because we believe that there's a lot of really wonderful things happening in other boroughs. And obviously Brooklyn has developed quite a name for itself, but mm-hmm. From the sort of idealist perspective of always wanting to live in New York City, Manhattan was what I always had my eyes set on. And it's really our goal to kind of continue to, how I see it, continue a legacy of artistic creativity within Manhattan. Mm. And in addition to Spring Street Social Society, I'm also getting ready to launch an app and a website called The Liquor Cabinet, which is a company that I founded with my two brothers, one who is based in Denver and the other who's in Minneapolis. And the three of us started that company earlier this year, and we're hard at work on the development of the app specifically, which will launch at the end of November. And that whole project is really focused on creating a space for telling stories about spirits and cocktails and providing a resource where I don't really think there exists one for liquor and cocktails in a kind of in a culture where people are increasingly interested in their food and drink and the provenance of where those things comes from. There's not really a great resource to be talking about that with liquor specifically. So I hope to provide that resource.
So you've got this really sort of multi-hyphenate career that has really touched almost every aspect of the arts, it sounds like. And I'm curious what the early parts of your life, you know, childhood growing up, adolescence, were like that would ultimately lead you down this sort of multi-hyphenate trajectory.
I think that from a young age, I was always very curious, and I had a lot of hobbies. I think I probably owe a lot of my work ethic and the ability to take on a lot of things to my parents, who from a young age started a regimen of chores and task making for my brothers and myself, and really kind of I think encouraged us to be independent and to kind of seek the things that we wanted to, and were very encouraging in that way. Some very kind of funny things I think that I could talk about that in terms of my activities as a kid. I performed in my first play when I was 8. I was cast as Kurt in The Sound of Music at a local dinner theater called the Carousel Dinner Theater in Fort Collins. I had seen listings for auditions in the local newspaper. I would actually, I would scan religiously the back of the entertainment section every Friday, looking. I knew that auditions were listed there, and I was looking every week. I would scour for auditions for kids. I don't think I had even ever performed before, but I knew it was something that I would like to do. And when I finally came across auditions for The Sound of Music, I asked my mom to take me to the auditions. And I remember sitting in the car with my mom, not yet going into the audition, and bawling my eyes out because I was so scared. But I had dragged my mom to take me there. And so she, with some help and encouragement, I finally got through the doors, auditioned, and then landed my first role. It wasn't always so successful. I remember auditioning for a children's chorus in Fort Collins repeatedly, year after year, and never actually making it into that elite group, that children's chorale. But at the same time, I was pursuing things. I was pretty actively involved in 4-H. And while a lot of kids in the community were doing things like, you know, raising cattle and sheep and kind of agricultural related activities, I was focused more on kind of like hobbyist interests. So I was doing model rocketry for a little while. I think I did 1 year of woodworking, I believe. But then I was also doing much more sort of like homemaking crafts. I studied cake decorating. I did study photography. So from a young age, I think I was very interested kind of in the visual arts. The cake decorating specifically was something that stuck with me all throughout high school. And when I was 13, I actually had decorated my first wedding cake for a cousin.
Wow.
And that sort of turned into a side job throughout high school where, you know, friends and friends of friends would hire me to design and decorate their wedding cakes. And that actually, I think, led to me specifically to being really interested in the media surrounding weddings. So I really was fascinated with the world of Martha Stewart weddings. So I actually credit the magazine, Martha Stewart Living and Martha Stewart Weddings, for like a lot of the kind of aspirational bent that I took when it comes to like entertaining, hosting, I think when it comes to like kind of style and design, mm-hmm. I think that publication was was really a game changer in terms of, being able to kind of focus editorially on kind of like across a lifestyle, as opposed to being like really specific in one, you know, in one pursuit, such as just home decor or cooking or that sort of thing. So I actually credit the Martha Stewart Living Omnimedia company as a pretty large influence in my life. While at the same time, and I continued doing like cake decorating. I was cooking with my mom a lot. I was gardening with my mom. And then at the same time, I was quite academic. When I was 16, I applied for a position as a page in the House of Representatives in Washington, D.C., and I got that position. So I left for my junior year of high school and lived in a dorm with other pages and served on the House floor for a whole school year. And while politics was maybe something that was interesting and that, you know, I think it's generally fascinating, and I was curious as a learner, I think I was much more interested in just having an experience at 16 where I could get away from the house and sort of live. I actually remember my brother was a page 2 years before I was, and so that's how I even knew about the program. I had visited when he graduated, and I remember being fascinated when we as a family were there to see him at his graduation. And immediately after the graduation, he left with his friends to go, go out to dinner somewhere. And that day I had remembered walking somewhere through Washington, D.C. in some neighborhood and just being so excited by the idea of these wonderful little restaurants with their windows flung open and people dining on the streets, and knowing that my brother at 16 was going off with his friends to like live that lifestyle. I was jealous, and I was like mesmerized. So more than anything, I think that I was kind of interested in getting away from the house and developing my own sense of lifestyle, and kind of discovering that at a young age, sort of independently. So I think that was, you know, living on, sort of on my own with a group of 70 other 16-year-olds was, I think, a pretty a meaningful time for me and kind of a turning point. And then, yeah, and I think throughout high school, I increasingly became interested in design, graphic design, in the visual arts. So while I was continuing to do more theater, regional theater, dinner theater, I was also, I figured that, better to study, the graphic arts than theater when I went to college. I actually didn't really drink. I didn't drink at all. Growing up, I came from a very conservative Christian household, and I, for my part, was pretty, was sort of on board with all of the religious guidelines and moral guidelines that I was taught. So I was a pretty good kid in terms of, you know, obeying the rules. While I tend to flout the rules that I think are unnecessary. Mm-hmm. I definitely am a risk taker. I also, you know, am happy to play within the bounds. So I never drank growing up, and it wasn't until I was 21 that I really, you know, started drinking at all. And, of course, to like, you know, to some extent, just enjoying nights out with friends and having my share of drunk nights. I actually was really becoming interested in, as I think in high school, I was interested in food more and cooking at home. I became more interested in drinking from a much more kind of like educated standpoint. And it was when I was a little bit older, like 25 or 26, and I was on a trip in the south of France, and I had pastis for the first time, and it was a spirit that I had never tried before, and I at first didn't really like it. I've never really been a huge fan of like an anise or licorice flavor, but over the course of like a couple weeks in the south of France, I grew to really enjoy the taste of pastis. But more than that, I really began to understand how it was really a part of the culture, and it was really specific to that place. And the story of, you know, sort of basically seeing the lifestyle of seeing old men drinking their pastis, playing pétanque in the park, and having that kind of that regimen and of that drink kind of associated with that lifestyle, I found really intriguing. Just the fact that there's so much that can be said about our cultures and about the history of our cultures and the way that we live that is so connected to the way that we drink. And that was really the first time that I became really fascinated with spirits, and I think was the seed that was planted in my mind that led me to form the liquor cabinet.
So you know, these are really interesting and unusual pursuits, I think, for anybody, even at, you know, at a young age, let alone a male. And I'm curious, you come from a creative family. Like, what kind of relationship do you have with your parents that would, you know, shape and influence these activities?
What relationship I have with my parents?
Yeah, like, are they creatives, artists? Like, is that just something that was, you know, part of your upbringing? Because, I mean, so much of this, I don't, like, it doesn't seem like the standard sort of, you know, linear path upbringing that I'm, you know, being an Indian kid that I've been, you know, exposed to.
Yeah, definitely. I think that a large part of my creative pursuits come from my mother. My mother has a dedicated craft room in her basement, and I remember driving away to my freshman year of college, and I like to joke that I turned around. I drove myself down to Florida my freshman year, and I remember turning around as I was driving off to wave goodbye, and all I could see was my mother running back into the house to turn my room into her craft room, which I don't think is too inaccurate or too far from the truth. I shared a lot of, as I said, I like to cook with my mom growing up. And so I learned at least how to follow recipes. I also like to say that, you know, my mom has always been really good at following recipes and is a great cook. However, when I was a little bit older and kind of starting to enjoy my own cooking in a more creative way, I was the one to kind of substitute things here or there, start to throw in extra ingredients and really think about how I wanted something to taste as opposed to just following a recipe. And that was always the hardest thing for my mom. So there was a point at which my mom sort of inspired me and laid the groundwork. And then I was able to kind of use my creative expression beyond that. You know, my dad was a big cyclist. And I think the connection that I have with my dad has always been a little bit of wanderlust. And my dad's family in general, the Janelle side, I think we all kind of share that value. Can't really sit still in one place. When I was 13, my dad and mom were kind of tired of the big city. And I put that in quotes because I lived in Fort Collins, which was probably less than 200,000 people. And they were ready to have a quieter, slower life. And we moved. My parents decided to uproot us. We were going to move. This is actually while I was in the middle of a production. So I was going to finish out this production while my mom stayed with me in Fort Collins, and my dad and brothers were going to move to a small town in Kansas called Lindsberg, the Swedish capital of Kansas, and probably, like, you know, 600 people. So it was definitely downsizing in terms of our community, and we moved there for a weekend. And at the end of the weekend, after we had had most of our things out there, we had the down payment on the house. I wasn't privy to this conversation, but whatever transpired between my parents on a Sunday morning, my brothers and I woke up, and my brother and my parents told us that we were all moving back to Colorado. So I think that, not to say that we're always so indecisive, but I think that there's definitely a sense within our family that that taking a risk is okay, mm-hmm. and not always being sure of where that will lead is also part of the story. When I was 20, a bit older, when I was 27 or 28, so all of my brothers and I were out of the house. My parents actually moved down to Colombia, South America, for 2 years, and my mom took a job as a teacher at an international school. My mom's a high school math teacher, and. You know, we had always stayed in the same hometown growing up, with the exception of that one weekend in Kansas. But you know, I think that there always has been a sense of adventure and also just sort of encouragement within that, within my family. So yeah, so all that to say, I actually have a wonderful relationship with my parents. Mm-hmm. I think that there's always been. There's been a strong support of any of the endeavors that I've taken upon. And I think that there's definitely been inspiration from my parents. But I think that, too, I've always kind of push the limits on anything that has come my way through them. Mm.
So I want to talk a little bit about the psychology of risk, and I have a lot of questions about this. But one of the other questions I want to ask you before we get there is what you learned about human behavior and communication from your time, you know, being exposed to politics as a page that has made its way into your work later in your life, and what you think might be useful for our listeners from that.
I'm sorry, specifically about...
Well, what did you learn about human behavior and communication from your time working as a page?
I think one of the things that really stuck with me the most, there were a group of us who were 16 years old. We were there to provide a utility, ostensibly. I mean, this was in a time when cell phones hadn't quite made their way into, you know, mass culture. Pagers were the way in which people communicated mostly. But we, as pages, were there to kind of like facilitate the moving of messages around and documents and retrieving congressmen from the House floor when there was a vote and somebody from their office needed to get a hold of them. I actually had to sit and the first 2 weeks that I was in Washington, D.C., I had to sit on the House floor and memorize. We had a little like guidebook of all of the names and faces of the congressmen. So I had to be able to identify each one of them by name and by face. But we were there purely to provide, you know, sort of a service for the congressman. There was something, though, about the people that we actually really connected, the congressmen that we really respected and that we really connected to, were those who actually took the time to stop and say hello, and some who even, you know, maybe knew a couple of our names because we worked specific jobs where they might have more interaction with us. And I remember, regardless of that person's politics, mm-hmm. We had a very strong affinity for those people who actually decided to give, you know, a moment's notice to the people who were supporting them. I think more than anything, that was what I took away. And maybe it's because I'm sort of sensitive to that myself in general, and that, you know, I really believe in the value of people in general. And I honestly believe too, that, that you only are creating more, a more advantageous position for yourself as a leader, by giving respect to those people who support you.
Mm. Well, from this, you know, experience of going through all these auditions and, you know, taking a shot at acting, what are the things you learned about grit and persistence from that experience?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I'm very persistent. I have perseverance, but I'm not sure if I learned this specifically from acting, but I think it really kind of like clarified something in the way that I work as a human, and that, you know, when you're putting yourself in auditions, you're essentially putting yourself into this huge pool of people and not providing any opportunity for yourself to stand out. You know, the only way that you're going to stand out is if you're going to be exactly the right thing that the people in the room are already looking for. So the thing that I found really frustrating about going to all of these auditions is that it wasn't really about how good I was, and it wasn't the value that I knew that I had and the talent that I had. All of these things actually had like very little relevance to the actual pursuit of what was happening. And I'm not really one to just sit and be somebody in a sea of people, because I believe that I have a lot more to offer. So I think that, you know, a big part of me deciding that pursuing acting, at least in this way, was not something that I was interested in, had so much more to do with me not being willing to sort of like put myself at the level of, you know, hundreds, thousands of other people. Instead, how can I provide a platform for myself and essentially want people to come to me, mm-hmm. as opposed to being the one essentially begging for a role or for a job? And you know, the reason that perseverance, I think, does pay off for a lot of people is that ultimately you just keep going and keep going and keep going until you are the right one that people are looking for. But that's not really the way that I work. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I still have acting ambitions. And I'm not exactly sure how those will kind of pan out. But, you know, in some, I think in a, actually a very, in a very straightforward way, me hosting events as a part of Spring Street Social Society and my pursuit of leading this sort of like cultural community is in itself, you know, some type of performance, mm-hmm. as is my work on Instagram. You know, I do believe that the best kind of performance is authentic. So I don't by any means mean to say that it's disingenuous, but the times when I feel like if I can blaze my own trail, I can make my own sort of stage for myself and my own platform to speak from, and do that in a way that I know is very compelling and really comes from myself. That to me is just as much that's much more valuable in terms of this pursuit of creativity than going into a room to audition for a role.
To more on my conversation with Patrick after this short message from our sponsors. Today's episode is brought to you by Warby Parker. They make glasses that are so cool that I don't even need glasses, and I still ordered a pair for myself. Glasses shouldn't cost as much as an iPhone, and their prescription glasses start at $95, including prescription lenses. Their titanium collection starts at $145, including prescription lenses. And if you haven't experienced the home try-on program, it's worth it to check them out just for that. It's one of the most unmistakable customer experiences I've ever had, so much so that I felt compelled to include them in my upcoming book as an example of something unmistakable. The home try-on program allows customers to order 5 pairs of glasses to be shipped directly to you, where you can try them on in the comfort of your own home and get feedback from friends, family, and colleagues. You can keep the frame for 5 days before sending them back free using the prepaid shipping and return label with no obligation to purchase. All the glasses include anti-reflective and anti-glare coating, and there's no additional cost. And they include a hard case and cleaning cloth, and there are no additional items that you'll need to purchase. They make buying glasses online easy and risk-free. So if you're a guy and you want to get your Clark Kent look going, or a girl that wants a really fashionable pair of glasses, be sure to visit warbyparker.com/creative and use the promo code creative for a discount just for Unmistakable Creative listeners. Now, back to my conversation with Patrick.
Well, let's talk about risk a little bit. One of the things that you said is that risk was something that was encouraged when you were growing up. And I don't entirely think that's normal. Maybe it's partially because of the upbringing I've had, but I also, you know, I've had hundreds of conversations with people about this. And the question I have about risk is whether you think it's something that can be learned, the capacity to take risks and to keep leveling up and taking bigger and bigger risks, or you think there's something just inherently built into some people that gives them that ability.
I think it's definitely a combination of learned behavior and behavior that exists naturally. I remember, there's a strong connection between risk and fear, right? Mm-hmm. So I've never really thought of anything as taking a risk. I've seen things as being scary, and I've seen things as sort of like facing fear. But that has never really been, that's never really equated to me as like risk taking. I only know that it's risk taking because that's what everybody else tells me. Mm-hmm. I remember a story. I don't know if I remember this because I experienced it or because my parents told it to me. I must have probably been 5 or 6, but I remember, I feel like I remember watching my parents drive away. I was in a cul-de-sac in Fort Collins. I was 5 or 6. My parents had told me that I needed to get in the car or they were leaving without me. And I didn't get in the car. I didn't want to go. And I remember watching them drive away and sitting there and probably being angry, but also feeling very self-righteous. And at a certain point, my parents came back and they had to come back to get me. They weren't going to leave me. So I think that happened when I was very young. And therefore, it was probably something that a quality that existed inside me and that was not learned. But what's interesting is that maybe my parents didn't necessarily encourage that behavior, but they also really, they accepted me, knowing that I was a stubborn child, probably shaping me in certain ways, but also understanding that at certain times I was going to do what I was going to do, and they had to learn how to kind of like, I guess, work within that framework. That's part of the reason when, you know, when I was 1918 and I went to college for the first time, I wanted to drive down to school alone by myself. And it was never even a discussion. I don't think that my parents even necessarily wanted to. But by that time, I think my parents realized that I was willing to, you know, kind of like make my own rules. Mm-hmm. And they were okay with that. So I think that there was certainly, there certainly has never been any pushback in terms of, you know, my parents feeling like something needed to happen a certain way just because. I think that there's also a strong amount of logic that allows me to kind of, I guess, take certain risks or do something that otherwise might be scary. I don't know that my logic is always actually correct. But I think that in a lot of cases, let's say, for instance, moving to New York City and not having a job, my logic is, what is my choice, or what are the options? There's certainly not an option that I would not find a place to live, that I wouldn't find a job. And, you know, worst case scenario, those things didn't happen. I'm sure that I could move back to Colorado and move in with my parents. But ultimately, the risk is that I don't ever have the experience that I want. Whereas the risk is not actually that I won't find a job or that I won't find a place, because I actually don't really see that as a possibility. So that's kind of my maybe like slightly skewed logic. But yeah, I think that it comes down to allowing, you know, a very open type of logic to kind of like dictate what is risky and what is not.
Well, let's shift gears a little bit. Let's actually start talking about, you know, sort of the creative work that you've done. Like I said, I mean, you've had your hands in so many different things, and I've asked this question in some form or another to a handful of people. I'm curious, you know, how each art form has influenced and shaped the work that you've done in the others. Like, you know, what did acting teach you about photography? What did cake decorating teach you about acting? You know, given that you have this sort of multi-hyphenate body of work, it's not just, you know, one question, but, you know, what did each of these art forms teach you about the others?
I don't know that I have any maybe real specifics. I'll try to think if I do. But I think ultimately, the way that I approach any project that I work on now is that whatever is kind of like the typical approach, the typical list of things that need to happen in order for something to be executed, I'm not really willing to stop there, because I understand that I guess I try to be very comprehensive in the way that I look at a project, and maybe I'm not always the best person to let's say, if it's a Spring Street Social Society project, not always the best person to perform, to design the menu, to style the space, to cook the food. But I also understand, like, I have a very strong interest in all of those things. And so really what it comes down to is that the details matter. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really interested in having had, you know, a pretty pretty extensive amount of experience in a variety of things. It just gives me, I guess, more of an education to kind of understand how the details from the things that I don't necessarily even understand fully are very important. And if I don't understand them fully, or maybe I don't have the bandwidth to sort of like take on that aspect of a project, that there is somebody who is there. Another way to think of that is, you know, I love the theater, and I love theater in general. But one of the things that I find kind of so sad about going to the theater in New York City is so often the experience itself is so lacking theatricality. You know, we're kind of in this place where going to dinner at a restaurant is such a theatrical experience, from the design of the place to the way that the food is prepared to the, you know, the chef kind of as that personality behind the food. There's so much, you know, hospitality has really become a theatrical experience, whereas theater is, you know, one, lacking in hospitality and therefore lacking in much theater outside of what's happening on stage. Uh-huh. Spring Street Social Society is actually producing its first play in a month at the beginning of November. It's of our interest too, to think of like, how can we bring these things that we do so well in the world of hospitality mm-hmm. into this more traditional framework of presenting a play, a theater, and how can we kind of like bring all of these worlds together? So even though cake decorating maybe enters nowhere into these things, you know, for a long time, I obsessed over the details of how to ice a cake and make the frosting appear smooth, or how to shape a flower, mm-hmm. the colors that went into something. You know, I was thinking very specifically and visually about this. So there's no way that I can then step back into another project and just thinking that having, you know, accomplishing a play on a stage is enough. Like, what are those intricate details that make this a really special experience?
I think you and I share that in common. You know, for some people listening, they know we put on a live event, a conference, and my entire approach to that conference was theatrical performances and movies and music are far more entertaining than conferences, so we should treat it as if we're putting on one of those events, and we'll blend the conference content in underneath all the theatrics. Right. Would you say that this sort of theatricality is sort of a defining ethos of all the work that you do? Like, is it a thread that runs through everything that you work on?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that in the sense that I do think that there's, you know, there's a certain level of performance because I'm very interested in how you can sort of like present a body of work and hide all of the, you know, the backstitching mm-hmm. that is present. I think the more that you can kind of create almost that fourth wall of this world exists and we're not even going to talk about, you know, the part that makes it work. That is how I see performance as actually working really well. And that's not to say that that has nothing to do with communication, or being able to like healthily communicate with somebody. I think this is, you know, very specifically about the sort of like creative endeavors that I'm involved with. I think it's very important to talk about the things that aren't working. Mm-hmm. But with the people who are relevant. So the more that you can do to provide this sort of like seamless, beautiful experience in which everything seems, you know, sort of like perfectly executed, I definitely see that as a form of performance in theater.
Well, let's talk about photography for a little bit. You know, I have a lot of questions out of morbid curiosity. I mean, when you look through the lens to create a story or to capture a moment, what do you look for and how do you bring something like that to life? Like, what is your creative process?
Well, let me say first, the metaphor of the lens is funny, or maybe the actual referencing of the lens is funny, because I don't actually have a lens to speak of. I use my iPhone to shoot all of my photography. Uh-huh. And I actually don't really consider myself a photographer, in as much as I don't actually own, you know, a DSLR. And I don't, in as much as a lot of my work that I do for clients comes through Instagram, I see it as much more of a kind of, the value of what I'm doing is actually reaching an audience and the story that I'm telling through a beautiful image, mm-hmm. but the actual piece of imagery in itself is not as valuable as kind of like the whole world in which it's created and showcased. That's a minor distinction, also because I don't ever book gigs just as a photographer. But that's to say, I do have very specific viewpoint on what I'm creating. And also, I think to the point of where these images are showcased is actually part of how I approach taking photos and capturing images. When I was 21, 22, 23, I think actually, I had left school in Florida and I was moving to California to pursue acting. I had bought a Vespa, a new a 250cc engine Vespa, got my motorcycle license because it was big enough to need a motorcycle license, and I drove the Vespa cross country. So that's actually how I moved from Florida to Los Angeles. And I remember I kind of started a blog at the time because I loved the kind of like visual nature of what I was doing. Again, I felt it was some sort of, you know, performance, and that I'm, you know, driving this little vehicle cross country, and, you know, most people's reaction is well, that's crazy. How long did it take you? I know that those questions are coming, and that's why I'm, you know, sort of like creating this experience. I wanted to have a way to showcase these sort of like vignettes as I saw them, where I'm driving across my scooter across Texas in the middle of the desert. And like, what does that scene look like? And capturing that in a way that not only am I having that experience, but I can like take this image that that is able to communicate that experience and resonate with an audience who wasn't actually there. And I actually wanted to be able to do that and connect that to maybe a timeline and a map. And this is before Instagram existed, but I think I really just wanted Instagram. Mm-hmm. So I think I was very well set up when Instagram was actually, you know, a thing to start documenting moments is really how I see my photography skills is what is a moment that can be expressed in just an image that gives the viewer just as much of an emotional connection as if they had been there themselves. And sometimes the thing that you have in person, there's other triggers that actually give you that connection. So it's actually finding what's the vantage point and what is actually within that frame that both the, you know, the layout of the image, the composition, the coloring, all of these things, the styling, maybe, what are those things that need to be present in order to kind of like create that same emotional connection?
It's interesting. Like as I've listened to you tell this story, it sounds like performance really and cultivating experiences for an audience is really the underlying thread that seems to tie your entire body of work together.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So one question about that, how do people start to bring that into their own work?
Well, I mean, I guess the question is it necessary for everybody to, yeah. I think it's really a matter of being able to understand. I mean, you have to come at it from the audience perspective, right? It's like, what does the audience actually want? If you're talking in very, you know, kind of dry marketing terms, like who is your audience? Mm-hmm. Who are you talking to? What's your demographic? What do they want? And whereas I think that there's, you know, there can be on the one hand a certain level of taste and maybe even experience that allows one person as a creator to kind of communicate that. I think that there's a large amount of trial and error as well. When I give workshops on Instagram and social media and mobile photography. And one of the points that I like to make is that every medium, is a different platform with different rules, just in the same way that an image, hung on a wall at a home or in a gallery is different than an image that's printed in a magazine. Mm-hmm. That's different than an image that you'll find on Instagram. That's different than an image on Twitter or even Pinterest for that matter. So really understanding like what is the platform with which you're communicating and how do you connect with an audience? So it's much about as understanding the audience as what is that platform that you're using. I think also, I've had this really great run for the last like 3 or 4 years since I moved to New York City. But, I spent most of my 20s, certainly living in more obscurity than I am now. Mm-hmm. And having many, many creative pursuits that honestly, you know, at least in that short term, didn't really seem like they were going anywhere. I left Los Angeles and all that I had under my belt was a couple of student films and a role as an extra in Pirates of the Caribbean, which was pretty fun, but there were no credits associated with that. I moved to Germany and I learned a little bit of German and I can, you know, order a meal at a restaurant in German. I had some jobs as a graphic designer. I joined a local English speaking community theater, but I didn't leave Germany with any sort of newfound edge or, you know, sort of creative oeuvre of any type. While those things definitely were learning opportunities and experiences that allowed me to be where I am at now, I think that there was also, One, I think that the medium of Instagram has really resonated with me in a way that nothing else really has. It's come before. And I think that also, you know, I started blogging at a certain point, and I've had a couple of different blogs. And when I was in Germany, I had friends who were developing these really great creative communities through Twitter and on Flickr. A lot of my friends from art school were using Flickr as a way to kind of like create a visibility for themselves and artists, and even start to sell their artwork and all of these things. And that was just something that never really took off for me as much or as little as I tried. So I think that there's that, all that to say, it's both the level with which you create and execute, but it's also, you know, there's also a certain amount of just sort of timing and also learning and understanding that, that certain things that don't actually take hold, either because it's maybe just not the right way for you to work, or maybe you haven't learned as much as you need to learn.
Well, this has been really, really interesting. I like conversations like this because they give you a lot to think about. They're not necessarily a map, but more of a compass, which I've said 1,000 times. So I'm going to finish with one last question, which is how we finish all our interviews. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
You know, I think it's really, it's honesty, integrity, and courage and self-confidence. I think the moment that somebody is willing to kind of own everything about themselves, mm-hmm. And willing to really sort of like be honest and authentic, and therefore not sort of apologizing for themselves, I think that, and so, yeah, I'm talking about people here, maybe more than a project or, yeah. You know, a product or a thing, which is ultimately what I care about, I think, is I care about the person, which I think is also to say to care about the experience, because ultimately a product is only as good as the experience that provides, which is only as good as that sort of like interaction that you have as a human. So I will say bringing it back down to the human level, honesty and integrity. Huh.
Well, Patrick, this has been really great, and I really appreciate you taking the time to join us and share your story and your insights with our listeners.
Yeah, well, thank you for listening. I appreciate it. Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Wednesday on The Unmistakable Creative.
Empathy is an understanding of feelings and needs. That's it. Feelings and needs. Feelings are all of the emotions that we as humans experience. I'm scared. I'm tired. I'm nervous. I'm concerned. I'm confused. I'm resentful. I'm excited. I'm happy, etc. We know those feelings. Sometimes we don't recognize that we're feeling them, or we don't give, you know, voice to those feelings. But there are studies that show that we experience upwards of 60 emotions on a daily basis. So we are emotional beings. And what is happening as we experience these emotions is that they are giving us clues to our unmet needs.
Tune in for my conversation with Whitney Hess about how to design a more self-aware life.